Hello and welcome to NewsHour. It's coming to you live from the BBC World Service studios in central London. I'm Tim Franks. And we're starting with the news that a ceasefire between Israel and the Lebanese militia Hezbollah appears close. The Israeli Security Cabinet is due to meet tomorrow afternoon, local time, to discuss a deal which it seems, according to the wide reporting and wide briefing going on, would amount initially to a 60-day truce. Israeli forces would pull back from southern Lebanon. Hezbollah forces would head north, north of the Litani River, about 20 miles or 30 kilometres from the border with Israel. Hezbollah started firing missiles into Israel on October the 8th last year, the day after the Hamas massacres, which precipitated Israel's devastating offensive inside Gaza. The conflict roared into far greater intensity in Lebanon between Hezbollah and Israel last month, since when at least 3,700 people have been killed, according to the Lebanese authorities, and more than a million forced from their homes. Those same Lebanese officials say that Israeli airstrikes today killed a further 31 people. In a moment, we'll hear from a minister in Lebanon. First, Neri Zilber is a journalist based in Tel Aviv and an advisor to the think tank and advocacy group, the Israeli Policy Forum. What's he hearing?
Nothing is complete, especially in Israel, until it actually comes to a vote, and that's the prerogative of the Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu. But according to our information, the cabinet is set to meet tomorrow, and is set to actually vote on whether to approve the ceasefire deal, drafted and brokered, obviously, by the Biden administration. The mood music and direction of travel is quite positive and has been now for the past week. And best information that we have is that it's just a matter of days, perhaps, until a ceasefire comes into place. And the first step towards that is Israel actually agreeing to the terms. Netanyahu is coming under pressure from his right-wing flank inside the government. That should be noted. He's also coming under pressure from the opposition, who's saying that this deal doesn't go far enough and that it's a premature end to the war. But overall, I think there's majority support both in the cabinet and Netanyahu's government to get this passed.
And then there are all the questions about how it might work, how there might be multinational monitoring, how far Israel has a right to respond to what it deems to be violations. Any details on that?
Well, you're right. It's a complicated document that hasn't, by the way, been made public in its final form. So we're all speculating just based on our own sources and information. But yes, the main sticking points are twofold. Number one, the monitoring mechanism that is set to be reinforced that will, quote unquote, referee the ceasefire and whether both sides are actually implementing the ceasefire. The United States, France, Lebanon itself, and maybe perhaps the European and Arab state will be part of that international mechanism. And the second issue that has drawn certain greater scrutiny is whether Israel will actually be given the right, at least from the United States, to, quote unquote, enforce any violations by Hezbollah that it sees in the months and years ahead. We believe that those two sticking points have been resolved. So really, it should be a smooth path to agreement.
I mean, I guess it also seems to suggest that the Lebanese army would somehow replace Hezbollah in the south and police all this. I mean, that seems like a version of the Security Council Resolution 1701 from 2006 that didn't really work.
Well, that's exactly right. The basis for that is that the Security Council resolution. The idea now, it'll be implemented in a better fashion. But you're right, Tim. The real crux of the weeks and months ahead isn't so much between Israel and Hezbollah. It's what happens inside Lebanon, where the Lebanese military, along with UN peacekeepers, can actually implement the terms of the ceasefire and what reaction they get from Hezbollah on their end.
Neri Zilber, journalist based in Tel Aviv. Lots of open questions, as Neri was suggesting. Does the next person you're going to hear from have any answers or any confidence that they can be answered? He's the Lebanese Minister of Finance, Youssef Khalil.
Unfortunately, I don't want to be negative on that, but it has never been very, if you wish, clear and very reliable. It's very often the case over the past year that people were expecting an agreement and did not get it. And people want an agreement. They need an agreement. They need good, if you wish, relationships so that they can live and they can survive what has been happening for the whole year. So they're very anxious that it doesn't work, and they're very unhappy that it doesn't work until the next month or the next couple of weeks, where people bid on a stable situation or an agreement. I hope this time it's going to be more serious than usual. I mean, it seems to be more stable than it used to.
Am I right in thinking that your understanding is that this will be a 60-day truce to begin with, and that there would be the Hezbollah militia would pull north of the Litani River, and that the Lebanese military would then move into that area to try and police southern Lebanon and ensure that calm is maintained there? Is that broadly the idea, as far as you are aware?
It is, indeed. Yeah, indeed it is. And starting today, by the way, the details that you've been are an element of 1701, but they were talked about and discussed today. Now, the 60 days to be spent by the Lebanese are being said and being announced very often. And the Israelis, but I haven't read it yet.
This deal seems to be based largely on the Security Council resolution, or the idea behind the Security Council resolution 1701, which had Hezbollah move north of the Litani River and the Lebanese army provide the sort of security guarantee. To be blunt, it didn't work. And that's why we are where we are now. What is the guarantee that the Lebanese army would do a better job this time round?
I think, I mean, the economy per se, because people were very, very angry about their revenue, especially small businesses and the lacking of microfinance and et cetera. These people on the medium run, even if they were very, very much pro the politics that were taking, you know, an important part of the economy, would not be easily accepted if people were to suffer from low incomes and very low public revenues. So this would be a very big pressure. And the two very important political parties in that, Amal and Hezbollah, are part of the discussion. And it is said that everybody is saying, okay, okay, okay. So it shows as if everybody has agreed. But it's too early today to make an announcement. Let's hope this will work.
And clearly, war is primarily about death and destruction and displacement and fear. But I guess for you, as the Minister of Finance in Lebanon, I mean, Lebanon has had terrible economic difficulties for goodness knows how long. And this last year must have been, you know, with all the destruction and with the fact that so many people have been displaced and businesses have had to close and so forth. Lebanon really needs a break from the chaos, doesn't it?
Yes, I'm so happy you're raising this. Last year, as you're saying, was an important one, was a difficult one, whereby very, very ugly things were seen on TV by babies of 4 years, what have you. Now, within our budget, we have money which is kept that would react to unforeseens. You know, Lebanon lives so much with unforeseens. And this particular years that we're losing today or tomorrow, hopefully, was able to react to the crisis. Socially, it's very, very ugly. Politically, very, very ugly.
And that was the Lebanese Minister of Finance, Youssef Khalil, speaking to me from Beirut. We got a rather bizarre story to tell you from Ukraine. It comes from the reporters at the Financial Times. You probably already heard the extensive reporting that thousands of North Korean soldiers have been deployed to fight the Ukrainians, currently occupying the Russian region of Kursk. But the people at the FT have gathered evidence that the Russians are also employing Yemenis to fight for them inside Ukraine. Charles Clover is the Financial Times correspondent with the story.
This is definitely one of the stranger stories to emerge from the Ukraine war, is this tale of these poor Yemenis, many of whom thought they were being sent to Russia to take high-paid civilian work and possibly get Russian citizenship. Instead, many of them arrived at the airport and were handed enlistment contracts and forced to join the Russian army. And due to a shortage of soldiers, the Russian army is relying more and more on foreign soldiers. There's this contingent of North Korean regular army sent to fight in the Kursk Oblast by Kim Jong-un. There are mercenaries, not just from Yemen, but there have been reports of mercenaries from India, from Africa, Nepal, all over the world. Many of them are just coming because it's high-paying work. Many of them, like the Yemenis, were tricked. The Yemenis are in a category, maybe in the middle, mercenaries, you know, and many of them don't even want to be there and don't want to take part in the fighting. And they are complaining loudly to anybody who will listen that they don't want to be in the battlefield. And many of them are being killed and injured. And it's very tragic. However, the people that are sending them there are doing it. This is the Houthi militia in Yemen are doing it for political reasons, similar to the reasons that, you know, for maybe, you know, ideological reasons, you know, the similar reason to why Kim Jong-un is sending his army is to take part in a war against the West.
I guess they would hope that there would be some quid pro quo as well, perhaps in terms of Russian know-how or even weaponry. But I'm just intrigued, Charles, that these Yemenis, maybe you just don't have the detail on this, but, you know, I wonder if they've been tricked into going and fighting and presumably don't speak Russian. So it's not as if they're in sort of regular, I mean, the North Koreans are presumably in some way being commanded by North Koreans. How this could possibly work?
Yeah, I mean, I think they're in units with each other. And I think some of them are in construction brigades. I talked to two Yemeni mercenaries, one who was in Ukraine now and another who was actually managed to get himself sent back to Yemen by way of Oman due to the intercession of some governments. And both of them said that they were forced to join the Russian army. They were in combat units, but the one that I spoke to, who's actually in Ukraine, when I spoke to him, he and his unit were building bunkers. So they were transporting timber, but they were, you know, very near the front line, and they were talking about being, you know, under barrage and landmines and things.
Have you any idea how many Yemenis may be in this scheme deployed in Ukraine?
The Yemeni that I spoke to, who's actually still in Ukraine, said that he came in September with a group of about 200 people. And we know that there had been groups before that, presumably were of similar size. So it's hundreds. It's probably not thousands. And in terms of strategic value to Russia, they're probably not very high. I mean, these are guys that don't necessarily want to be there, and they haven't really been trained. The North Koreans, which is a regular military unit, are probably much more effective, though I still don't know how effective those units are being either.
Charles Clover from the Financial Times. This is NewsHour. And coming up on the programme, do you tolerate singing along to a film at the cinema?
I think it's a matter of courtesy, really. For a start, if I'm paying money for something, I want to see the professionals sing. I don't want to hear anyone else who thinks they can sing, sing it badly or poorly.
Yeah, it's the hot debate right now over Wicked, the film. Some fans want to belt out the tunes. Others are furious about it. We'll get the opinions of two filmgoers on either side of the debate in half an hour. Our headlines this hour, as we've been hearing, Israel's cabinet will meet on Tuesday to discuss approving a ceasefire with Hezbollah, but a final agreement has not yet been reached. And Pakistan's capital, Islamabad, has spent a second day under lockdown as officials try to stop thousands of opposition supporters reaching the city. We're on that in just over 10 minutes. This is NewsHour, live from the BBC World Service with me, Tim Franks. A BBC Africa Eye investigation has exposed an extraordinary scam fueling a black market trade in babies in Nigeria. Women desperate to be mothers pay hundreds of dollars for drugs they're told will guarantee that they conceive. They're duped into believing that they're pregnant, in some cases for up to 2 years. Meanwhile, a baby is bought and sold in preparation for a fake birth. The BBC's Yemisi Adegoke has this report.
That's the sound of government officials raiding a building near Umunya, a town in Anambra, southeastern Nigeria. It's mobile phone footage from the state's Ministry of Health.
We saw six young girls.
Women with pregnant bellies stare blankly at the camera.
How many pregnant women lose yet?
It looks like an average health clinic, but it's a place where cryptic pregnancy scammers get their babies.
Are you pregnant?
Cryptic pregnancy is a medical term. It's when a woman is unaware she's pregnant until late in the pregnancy. It's a rare phenomenon, but here it refers to something completely different, a miracle fertility treatment. It's big business, and it's a scam. The women are taken to a nearby hospital. One of them agreed to speak to us if we didn't use her real name and changed her voice.
They said that after delivery, they will give me money.
How much money did they say they would give?
800,000.
800,000 naira.
She looks scared and confused. In her arms is a baby girl.
Now looking back, do you regret that decision?
I am still confused.
You're still confused. It's okay. It's okay.
Abortion is a criminal offence in Nigeria. Women face up to 7 years in prison. It's only permitted if the mother's life is in danger.
Some of these girls wouldn't want their parents to know. Then after giving birth, they will be given money.
Ife Obianabo is Anambra State's Commissioner for Women's Affairs.
Crypto pregnancy cannot exist without child trafficking. Anybody that tells you you will have a child through crypto pregnancy is a liar. You are going to be giving another person's child, a trafficked child.
My colleagues from the BBC in Lagos, Chiagozie and Abere, find another so-called cryptic pregnancy clinic. This one is also in Anambra. A secret camera shows dozens of women waiting inside a small hotel. Cheers of joy come from the consultation room. Someone has been told she's pregnant. They meet a woman who calls herself Dr. Ruth. For $200, she hands over a bag of unlabeled drugs, which, she says, will guarantee Ebere gets pregnant.
Okay.
When Ebere returns 4 weeks later, the miracle happens. She claims Ebere is pregnant, but it's a lie. Ebere did a pregnancy test at the hospital. It was negative.
It's not like normal pregnancy.
Dr. Ruth explains the baby can't be delivered until she's given another drug. This one costs around $1,000. We've heard numerous reports of how women do actually believe they've given birth. Some say they're given drugs and told to push. Others talk of waking up with a cesarean-like incision.
Miraculous break. I'm telling you with my experience.
Back at the commissioner's office in Anambra, a baby is at the centre of an extraordinary exchange.
I'm the one that carried it. Nobody carried it for me. Tell you what I passed through as a woman.
This woman got her baby through the cryptic pregnancy clinic that was raided in February.
Have you done any kind of DNA test?
They said it's negative. It will take time.
And you believe this cock and bull story? Are you not educated? All this story is a scam.
Throughout all of this, I couldn't take my eyes away from the tiny baby.
I'm a bit too. I don't know what the man is doing there. I went to hospital like others went to hospital.
The commissioner makes the couple agree if the biological parents come forward to claim the child, they would have to give him up.
I don't know, maybe it's just me, but like I still felt like empathy towards these parents. They believe that they went through this process and this is their child.
There are still many women, knowingly or not, falling for the cryptic pregnancy scam in Nigeria, fueling an underground trade in babies. The BBC asked Dr. Ruth to respond to the allegations made in this investigation, but did not receive any response.
Yemisi Adegoke with that investigation from Nigeria. It is the world's richest cricket league. Indeed, it's one of the most lucrative sports leagues around. Its TV rights sell for billions. And now the IPL, the Indian Premier League, has made the headlines for signing its youngest ever player. Vaibhav Suryavanshi is just 13 years old, and the Rajasthan Royals are paying more than $100,000 for his left-hand batting and spin bowling. Nikesh Rugani is a freelance cricket journalist based in Leicester, in England. 13 years old is incredibly young. What does he make of the signing?
For a start, I mean, I can remember what I was doing at 13 years old, and it was probably trying to trial for my school cricket team. And this lad, he's on the world stage now, rubbing shoulders with the very best players in the world. It is quite some story. I mean, look, in that part of the world, in India, it's not unusual for teenage cricketers to start playing at the top level. We've seen it with legendary players in the past, such as Sachin Tendulkar, who made his debut for Mumbai in domestic cricket in India at the age of 15, played for India at 16. But Suryavanshi has gone, you know, a couple of steps better than that. 13 years old, he's hardly played any top level cricket for his state, Bihar. He's played a few games. He's got a very modest average of 10 in first class cricket, but he's had some standout performances which have got him noticed, such as 100 off 58 balls for the India under-19s against Australia a couple of months ago, and a triple century in a domestic tournament in Bihar. Not a lot to go on, but he's scored volumes of runs at junior level. He's been for trials with the Rajasthan Royals, who ended up signing him in the IPL auction at one of their academies. And look, they've obviously liked what they've seen and think this guy could be the next big thing.
Yeah. I mean, clearly he is talented, but it just 13. Physically, most 13-year-olds are very, very different to, I mean, it's impressive that he was playing in the under-19s, but let alone, you know, the sort of grown professional players in the IPL. And the other thing about the IPL, you know far more than me, is that it's known for these sort of muscle-bound behemoths who sort of smite the ball hither and thither. He cannot be that boy, can he?
Well, he certainly doesn't look it. He's, you know, he's got a fairly typical 13-year-old build. He's quite slim and quite petite, as you'd expect in comparison to the men that are playing in the IPL. And you're right, you know, last season we saw some ridiculous scores in the IPL, you know, scores of 250 plus on a regular basis by some of the teams, including the Sunrisers Hyderabad. And a lot of that was brute strength and you know, the physical nature of batting in T20 cricket these days. So, look, it's going to be a massive step up for him. Whether or not he actually goes and plays any games for the Rajasthan Royals this season, we don't know, but he's been given a three-year contract.
Do you think, in that sense, Nikesh, it might be a bit of a PR stunt, this?
It could well be. But there was a bit of a battle between the Rajasthan Royals and the Delhi Capitals. So look, this kid is talented. It is good PR, but there's clearly something there for the future.
Indeed. Nikesh Rugani, freelance cricket journalist, looking forward to the career of Vaibhav Suryavanshi, signed at just 13 years old for the IPL. This is NewsHour. In Mozambique, the opposition leader, Venancio Mondlane, has called for 3 days of national mourning for the 50 people he claims were killed during weeks of violent protests in the country, which followed last month's general election. Ian Wafula has this report from Mozambique's capital, Maputo.
At San Francisco Xavier Cemetery in Maputo, the overlapping hymns from each chapel create a somber harmony unified by sorrow and heartbreak. Chapel number 3 stands out, though. Its mourners are strikingly young. Children gathering to bid a tearful farewell to 16-year-old Antonio Joaquim, whose life was tragically cut short. They said he was taking part in a Pots and Pans protest when police used live bullets to disperse crowds. Antonio is the latest casualty of weeks of protests that have gripped the country since the governing Frelimo party won the disputed presidential election in October. The party has been in power for 50 years. Manuel Samuel is Antonio's uncle.
They are killing innocent people without any reason. But many families are crying now, like myself.
Venancio Mondlane, a part-time pastor and independent candidate, insists he is the rightful winner of the vote. In recent weeks, his supporters have taken to the streets, demanding for his victory to be announced. The crisis deepened with assassinations of Venancio's lawyer and his colleague, a parliamentary candidate. Venancio alleges that at least 50 people have lost their lives, while civil rights groups have accused the police of using excessive force. It's 9 p.m. now. A new form of protest is about to start.
This is a show of frustration like nothing I've ever seen before. People are banging pots and pans, are blowing whistles, vehicles passing by are hooting. And the message is simple. They are saying that the recent elections were not free and fair, and they want their candidate, Venancio Mondlane, to be declared as winner. They are also saying that if they can't join the streets to go and protest, they will do it from the comfort of their homes. And this is happening all across the country.
As we're moving around the city, we came across this group of young people who are holding a vigil on behalf of one of them who they say was shot by the police officers. Police say they're investigating cases of alleged police brutality while also acknowledging losses within their own ranks. Here is Bernardino Rafael, the commander of police in Mozambique.
We recorded 103 injured people, and 69 of those were police officers. The demonstrators are using the children as a shield in front of them, and they themselves are behind. Consequently, they don't pay the price. Children should not be used because they are innocent. This is not a demonstration, and it is not about the elections, but it is about subversion and competition for terrorism in our country.
Police chief in Mozambique, ending that report by Ian Wafula. You're with NewsHour. It's live from the BBC. I'm Tim Franks. Our Pakistan correspondent Carrie Davis says there is a weary gag the locals in the capital Islamabad use about their city. They call it Container Stan because of the number of shipping containers the police are using to try to impede demonstrators. Pakistan may long have been a country mired in economic problems and violent instability and political dysfunction, and where politicians who fall from favour can often end up in prison or in exile. It is, though, a bit of a world leader in staging mass protests. And so today, Bushra Bibi, the wife of Pakistan's former Prime Minister Imran Khan, has told thousands of supporters that their attempt to occupy the streets of the capital will not cease until he is freed from jail. What's the scene then? Late this evening, Pakistan time. Here's our correspondent, Carrie Davis.
Tim, I've been going around sort of central Islamabad throughout the course of the day and seeing the security situation. A large amount of the streets have been closed off by shipping containers. The internet has, at best, is incredibly patchy, but mostly just completely cut unless you're on the Wi-Fi. And even if you are on Wi-Fi networks, quite a lot of people have complained of issues with certain apps. Being able to kind of communicate easily between people has become quite difficult given the level of restrictions. We've also obviously seen schools closed throughout today, and that will also happen again tomorrow. So really, quite a large amount of disruption happening here in Islamabad, in the capital city.
Imran Khan's been in jail, I think, since last year. So why has his wife called for this big demarche on Islamabad now?
Yes, you're completely right. He's been in prison since August of 2023. But we've seen several of these protests before. We've seen one actually as recently as early October, when we also saw the city being shut down. In fact, quite a lot of the locals have started referring to it as Container Stan, because these shipping containers seem to permanently sit by the sides of the road, ready to be dragged in front of them if the authorities feel that there is some form of threat, or they're trying to limit people's access in the city because of these sorts of protests.
Have you got a sense of just how much support there is for the PTI nationally, but also, and I also just wonder sort of what shape it's in, because I seem to remember that a lot of the leadership, it wasn't just about Imran Khan, a lot of the leadership were imprisoned or they went into hiding, and the party itself had been pretty much decimated. How strong do you think it is?
So there's definitely very strong support around the country for Imran Khan. He is an incredibly popular politician, and that was really obvious in the February elections. What we are waiting to see is whether or not that popularity, where people feel like they support him, that they want him, whether they are going to come out onto the streets. And at the moment, we've not seen a mass uprising across the country in support of Imran Khan. That has not happened. We obviously saw the 9th of May, there were protests. That was on the 9th of May last year when Imran Khan was first arrested. And there were protests, some of which turned violent and were directed towards military buildings. And since then, we saw a massive clampdown on Imran Khan's party. As you say, a lot of the leadership at that point were put into prison. Some of them left the party altogether and said they were leaving politics altogether. So Imran Khan's party still exists and is sort of still working very hard to try and keep him and their messaging in the public eye. Of course, they ran an entire election campaign and got the largest number of seats in the general election. But it is difficult having your leader in prison, particularly when there's quite often been moments when access to Imran Khan has been really limited, to try and get that sort of legitimacy and leadership directly from Imran Khan. And so there's also been, there's a lot of public pressure on the PTI leaders that are in the public eye, that are out there leading, to show their real commitment to Khan and to Khan's cause as well.
Carrie Davis speaking to me from Islamabad. We're going to head back to the war in Ukraine now, a war which escalated with Russia last week in terms of the weaponry used and the targets now in scope. There's also been a heightening in rhetoric, with Vladimir Putin saying that Russia had the right to target the military facilities of countries supplying weapons to Ukraine. It has undoubtedly been a topic of intense conversation in Berlin today, as defence ministers from the key European Union countries and the UK have been meeting. The Polish minister has been attending, and Poland has always insisted that Ukraine has every right to use Western-sent missiles against Russia in self-defence. But the country hosts several US military facilities, including one that Russian officials have identified as a possible target should the war intensify further. Our Eastern Europe correspondent Sarah Rainsford has this report.
There were celebrations in northern Poland this month as the ribbons were cut and flags raised at an American missile defence base. As Poland's president pointed out, the base was first planned when NATO was most worried about ballistic missiles from Iran or North Korea. Those were the days of George Bush and his axis of evil. Now it is Russia that's threatening to attack the West after Ukraine's allies supplied Kyiv with rockets that are hitting Russia. Vladimir Putin has warned he has the right to hit any military facility of those countries. And the foreign ministry spokeswoman has been pretty specific. Maria Zakharova said the new American base in Poland could be a priority target for Russia's newest missiles. So I headed for Rzeczykowa to see how people there were taking the threats.
There's a small yellow concrete chapel here, just next to the green fence and the barbed wire of the military base. The bells are ringing and there's quite a crowd of people heading now towards the main morning mass.
Regina told me she and her family were worried. It's all they're talking about, she says. But Joachim was clear. There is no way Putin would attack the United States here, he told me. It would be suicide.
Standing looking through this barbed wire and the fencing towards the American base here, it is extraordinary to think that relations with Russia are so hostile now that officials in Moscow can openly talk about targeting sites like this. But that's what Moscow wants. It wants the West to worry about just how far it could escalate things. And yet here in Poland, they've been living with the idea of Russia as a threat for a very long time now.
And Poland has suffered a lot from the Soviet times and from Russian imperialism. And Putin, as our neighbour, has been really sending threats to the entire region for a while already.
Back in Warsaw, I met Aleksandra Wiśniewska, an MP with the governing coalition. She's been to eastern Ukraine herself, delivering aid from Poland. And she is sure that the West has to go on helping Kyiv, whatever the warnings from Vladimir Putin.
We cannot right now sacrifice the fate of Ukraine, which is in desperate need, you know, of more military support, of increased humanitarian support.
Do you think that the West should continue to respond and to escalate its support for Ukraine, given that Vladimir Putin makes such open threats that he won't allow that?
What he's currently saying, you know, is not credible. I think that if we were to appease him in any way, shape or form, that would only strengthen the Russian aggression.
Poland, though, believes it's already under attack, not with rockets, but with actions meant to destabilize as well as cause damage. This was a giant shopping mall. It's now just a few heaps of bricks and rubbish and a couple of charred black walls. It is pretty strange looking at it to think that this fire could somehow be linked to Russia. But that is what the authorities are investigating. And not just here, but acts of arson and sabotage right across the country. And they describe it as part of a hybrid Russian war. When I ask a group of pensioners sheltering from the icy wind whether they're worried about Russian missile attacks, this lady just laughs. She tells me Putin's not the only one with rockets. But from the ruins of the shopping mall behind her, it seems like Russia's hybrid war on Europe has already escalated.
And that was our Eastern Europe correspondent, Sarah Rainsford, reporting from Poland. One of Britain's most successful authors, Barbara Taylor Bradford, has died. She was 91. She had the dream debut with her novel A Woman of Substance, sold more than 30 million copies and went on to become a hit TV show. Across her long career, she was prolific, writing 40 novels, all of which were worldwide bestsellers. For 20 years, Lynn Drew was Taylor Bradford's editor and publisher at HarperCollins. Why were the books such a sensational success?
She'd always been determined from a really young age to be a novelist. She'd been a reporter. She tried to write some sort of thrillery type novels and they just didn't work. She wasn't convinced with them at all. It was only when she went back to her own roots and her passion for Yorkshire and the stories, I think, of the Yorkshire landscape, books like The Brontes, you know, great classics of English literature, and that sweeping emotional setting that meant so much to her, particularly because by then she was living abroad, that she found her inspiration. The New York Times, I think, described the original Woman of Substance as a novel of love, courage, ambition, war, death, and passion. I mean, big words. Yeah.
Pretty much everything.
But you immediately see this was no romance. This storytelling power that she had to keep you turning the pages, and it's a long book, was right there from the very first page. And I think that essence of knowing what will grip the reader and make them understand those really basic human emotions and drivers was at the heart of her writing.
Yeah, and it's one thing to sort of come up with a book that is just and the extraordinary success that was. It's another thing to keep the novels coming. And she did so for such a long period of time, in such number. She must have had tremendous reserves of energy as well as imagination.
She was one of the most extraordinary people for energy I've ever met. She would always say to me, you can call me anytime, doesn't matter. I think what motivated her was not material success. It was the enormous fulfillment she got from first her journalism and then becoming a novelist. I have to say she was really good. She had the journalist's deadline sort of drilled into her. She actually really loved the editorial process. She would love having these long phone chats. Apparently Bob, her husband, would, you know, raise his eyebrows at the phone bill.
I know one of the sort of canards that you and others are very keen to demolish is that her genre was romance. And as you say from that New York Times review of the first book, it went far beyond that. I guess one of the other things that people have tended to say about Barbara Taylor Bradford is that these are works that are aimed at women. I mean, as if that would be a bad thing. But that's not entirely accurate, is it?
No. But I think at the same time, she knew that women make up a huge amount of the reading public when it comes to volume of sales. She knew from her own upbringing how much novels had meant to her. Her mother would read her the Brontes and read her Dickens, and she was quite a precociously young reader. It mattered to her that women saw themselves in stories. And she famously said, you know, women want to read about women who've made a success of their lives.
Lynn Drew for many years, Barbara Taylor Bradford's editor and publisher. This is NewsHour. And a reminder of our top story this hour, Israel's cabinet is due to meet on Tuesday to discuss approving a ceasefire with Hezbollah. but a final agreement has not, we're told, yet been reached. Neri Zilber, a journalist based in Tel Aviv, did tell us that the deal, certainly in Israel, is likely to be approved.
The mood music and direction of travel is quite positive and has been now for the past week. And best information that we have is that it's just a matter of days, perhaps, until a ceasefire comes into place. And the first step towards that is Israel actually agreeing to the terms.
One other headline story we've been covering, an Indian Premier League team has paid more than $100,000 for a 13-year-old cricketer, the tournament's youngest ever player. Now, there are a few things in the NewsHour office that are guaranteed to stir a vigorous exchange of opinions more than a discussion on etiquette. So we're going to indulge that passion with the question that's been consuming my colleagues and lots of other people, it seems. If you are at a cinema, a movie theatre, and you're enjoying a musical on the big screen, is it allowed, is it okay to break into song? It's the debate that's being had in and out of cinemas around the world as audiences jostle to see the highly promoted musical Wicked. And for some, it is a chance to sing along to the movie's best-known tunes. Others, though, don't want to hear anyone other than the movie stars singing at full volume. We've brought two people together on opposite sides to share their opinions. Sarah Cook is a Wicked superfan and author. Sasha Mooney is the owner of Futurist Cinema in Kidderminster in central England. NewsHour's Celia Hatton has been speaking to them. First to superfan Sarah. What does she think of the audience singing along?
I'm on the no singing, absolutely no singing, unless you're in a specific sing-along event.
Okay, we're going to have to pick that apart. And Sasha, what's your view on this? I mean, you own a theatre, don't you?
Yeah, I own a small independent cinema. And if it's not harming anybody, let them sing.
Okay, so we've got both sides. We've heard from some, for example, Dwayne The Rock Johnson, big Hollywood actor. Now, he says people pay good money for tickets, so they should be able to belt it out in the theatre if they want to. Sarah, why do you disagree with this idea?
I think it's a matter of courtesy, really. For a start, if I'm paying money for something, I want to see the professionals sing. I don't want to hear anyone else who thinks they can sing, sing it badly or poorly. And the other thing is that some people may not know the show entirely. So they might be coming into Wicked completely new, not knowing any of the songs, and then have it ruined by someone who's singing it off key behind them or like in front of them.
So you're a fan of Wicked. Have you seen it in the theatre so far? Has your viewing experience been ruined by any off-note singers?
Surprisingly, I've seen it twice and my experience has not been ruined. People have been relatively quiet. A lot of passionate mouthing along, but no bad singers so far.
And Sasha, what's been the experience so far with your theatre? Have you had to deal with anybody, you know, ticket holders who are furious with others?
No, not at all. I don't know whether they have been singing along. I'd be very surprised if they at least haven't been humming. And no, we've not had a single complaint at all. Everybody's come out. We've had one or two that have come out before the hour is up, but that generally happens. If somebody goes to a film and they're not ready for them, they'll come out before the hour is up, and you know that. But other than that, no, we've not had a single complaint. We are going to put on some separate screenings which are for sing-alongs. So where the idea is, you know, have a bottle of Prosecco and sing your little heart out. I do agree it's totally etiquette for it, but if somebody's singing in the cinema and it's not really harming others around them, then no, I would just say let them do it.
Does this all come down to etiquette, really?
Yeah.
Sarah, is singing along in enjoyment really that different from somebody who has a conversation next to you in the cinema?
I actually hate people having conversations next to me in the cinema. So yeah, for me, it's the same level. I think if you're going in, you're going in to shut out from the world, to be quiet and immerse yourself in the story. So be quiet as possible. Leave your phones in your bags and just enjoy what's on the screen.
I was going to say, there's certain element there I would totally agree. I think the one is on a slightly different level. The phones and the talking and all the rest of it is... that is definitely an etiquette, and it shouldn't, there should be far less. I think the singing is part of the euphoria of being in a crowd, watching that film. It's an atmosphere and euphoria. And that's ultimately some ways why we go to the theatre, why we go to the cinema, is to be part of that group euphoria of enjoyment at that moment. So I think the singing is slightly different. It's not the same as taking your phone out or talking to somebody. You're caught up in a moment.
Is this debate a new one, or are there past films? I'm thinking of things like Mamma Mia or Les Miserables that also have well-known scores. Have we seen this before, Sasha?
Oh, absolutely. I remember the first time I went and watched Commitments. I went back a second time to watch it so I could hum along to the film. I loved it. There was no soundtrack, but I loved the music. It was like, oh, right, I'll go back and watch it again so I can hum along. I think it's, yeah... it's, well, I think it'll sort of always be there. And it also is dependent upon, because as they say, horses for courses, it's dependent on different films. I will never go and watch Wicked. It's not my cup of tea. But anybody wants to go and watch it and see you sing with it. But I'll be there one of the first at the Rocky Horror.
And Sarah, what do you think? I mean, are we going to have singing and non-singing showings of films in the future?
But they do that, and that's why I think that if you want to go, like they're already planning sing-along events. There were sing-alongs for Matilda. Rocky Horror is a sing-along in its nature. You go, that's part of the experience. I've been to sing-along Great Showman, sing-along Frozen, and I think if you want to sing-along, go to those specific ones and belt your heart, because that's what people are paying to go do. If it's not a sing-along, keep your mouth shut.
If it's not disturbing someone else, live and let live. If it is disturbing of someone else, of course, then we can either look to ask them to keep quiet or move them to a different part of the cinema. Cinemas are quite big, generally. You can fit a few people in them. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, live and let live.
Sasha Mooney, the owner of Futurist Cinema and Kid... Sasha Mooney, the owner of Futurist Cinema in Kidderminster, and Sarah Cook, who's a Wicked superfan and author, and they were talking to Celia Hatton, my NewsHour colleague. And that brings this edition of NewsHour to a close from me, Tim Franks, and the rest of the team here in London. Thanks for your company.